Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full. Is it all doom and gloom? Heck no. I'm going to show you where the biggest bull market has just begun.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone. I am Chris Martinson, CEO and founder of peakfinancialinvesting.com, also peakprosperity.com. And Paul Kiker is off today, so it's just going to be a solo act, and I'm going to tell you about where I think this biggest bull market is right now, and it's astonishing. It's just gotten started, and of course, maybe you don't know this, but I'm a huge hard assets, natural resources fan, particularly at this stage of the cycle, and this is a chart that comes to us courtesy of Gehring and Rosenzweig. That's a little GNR down here, and they've run this chart, which let's talk through it. It looks at the ratio of spot commodities, spot prices for commodities compared to the S&P 500. And when it's this little green line is that ratio. And when it gets all the way up to here, it's maybe commodities are overvalued when it's above this small red dotted line. It's fairly valued when it gets down into the range of this heavier red dotted line. And so you'd be a little agnostic when you're on the heavy red dotted line. Do I want stocks? Do I want commodities? I don't know. But when you get down here and that green line is now below the lower red dotted line, you are definitely in the mode of saying, I think I'd prefer to be overweight in commodities at this time compared to stocks or equities. And you can see through history, it's just cycled over and over again. So commodities got real expensive down here around 1980. That was at the tail end of that double hump inflation. Talk more about that in a minute. Commodities got really undervalued here, and they are currently, as of today, super duper undervalued relative to equities. Now, why do commodities go through the cycle of being too expensive, too cheap, too expensive, too cheap? It's a well-known phenomenon, and it's called the commodities super cycle. And it starts here. You're at the top of the market. Just got this situation where you have demand destruction. You got mega mergers and all that stuff. But there's this moment where you have like too much investment, so you have too much supply, and then you get into surplus, and people are like, oh my God, get me out, we have way too much. Prices begin to fall, projects continue to get financed, however, and then you have an extreme surplus because we just came out of a deficit, so now we're coming into surplus, now we're in extreme surplus, and people are saying things like, this is going to zero, I'm never investing in commodities again, oil's going to be $12 a barrel. Because they don't know where they are in the cycle. This is just the commodity investment cycle. And then the market rebalances itself. You get down here to the bottom of the market. Why? Because surplus, you know what they say in commodities, the cure for high prices is high prices. So you have all these high prices for commodities. People invest in those commodities, bring more oil wells online, bring more copper mines online. They do those things. And then, you know what happens? You get all this stuff that comes out. And so the cure for high prices was high prices because we brought more supply online and that makes the prices fall again. And then you move into a situation where you start to move out of balance back into deficit again and people become cautious. They're like, hey, let's see what's happening. You get a lot of M&A, mergers and acquisition activity, which by the way, we're seeing in the shale oil patch big time right now, also in the mining space. And this is when insiders and professionals begin buying. They start, you know, accumulating quietly. Contrarian allocations. So I'm a contrarian investor for the most part. And then people start to say things like, I can't believe how cheap this stuff is. Maybe I should get some more of this stuff myself. And that's when the bull market starts. And then the bull market starts, but then you get into this place where you have these extreme deficits, right? And so we are somewhere right down this, we're on this side of the chart over here, okay? We're coming right up through this side of the investing cycle. So it was just a simple thing. We underinvested for a while. So that led to less supply. Less supply leads to higher prices for those things. And then those higher prices are going to attract more capital. And then more capital is going to come in and we're going to create more supplies. That's the commodity cycle. Well, we're coming out of one of the longest periods of underinvestment in commodities in history. I mean, it's been a long, dry road. You see here, normally you go up, you go down. Look at all this time it's spent balanced, decades, right? Little high, took decades to get back down to undervalued. But here we went from undervalued and barely touched the line and went undervalued again. This is a long stretch of lack of investment in commodities. So what's the result of that? We see here commodities total return, and I think commodities are just getting started here. I just do. Energy. Over the last year, the percentage gain is 96.2 for Brent oil, WTI crude 95, call that 96. U.S. natural gas, down. Gas oil, diesel, 146% up. New York, ultra-low sulfur diesel, 130% gains. Gasoline up 89%. Okay, how about metals, industrial metals? Wow, copper's up 38% over the last year. Aluminum, 49%. Nickel, 20%. Zinc, 37%. Lead, going backwards, need less lead because we're using fewer lead batteries and cars and things like that. Precious metals, let's go there for real quick. Gold up 45%. Silver, 161%. Oh my gosh, that's the top on the whole list here. Platinum, 115%. Palladium, 60%. I'm going to give you data later that explains why those are probably going higher. It's a supply story as well as a demand story. Interestingly, the grains have gone almost nowhere here over the past year, although they're really probably about to get started again because of the war in Iran, because of the lack of fertilizer, also because of a very crappy growing season for wheat here in the United States. Again, I'll show you some of that data later. And then we got these other things, coffee, cocoa, cotton. But I believe we're just getting started on the commodity cycle. So let's explain this. Let's talk about this with that commodity investment cycle. And let's take a quick peek at this. So I want to, let's do this around copper. Okay. And I think the copper bull market has arrived. It's not about to arrive. It has arrived. This is Robert Friedland. Here he is at the Qatar Economic Forum in 2023. I'm digging a little bit back into the history because I just want you to be aware of the fact that this copper bull market, it's not like it snuck up on us with no warning, right? Listen to Robert, the person who knows more about copper than anybody else in the world, talking to the Qatarians about this back in 2023.
Everything we do, everything we touch, we either mined it or we grew it agriculturally. And our species is trying to green the world economy by reducing the consumption of coal and hydrocarbon in the way we generate electrical energy, transmit electrical energy, and actually utilize it in an object like a microwave oven or a washing machine or your electric car. As a species, we have to find a way to mine more copper in the next 20 to 25 years than we've mined throughout human history in a period when most of the great copper mines have already been mined and are depleted. If we picture the periodic table behind us, copper conducts electrical energy, making these lights better than any other metal, than gold and silver, which are too expensive for the purpose.
It all makes sense. Why isn't the message getting through?
In New York, people think a ham sandwich comes from a refrigerator. So we are divorced from the supply chain. People flew here in airplanes or drove here in cars. If you're guilty of going to a hospital or riding a bicycle, you need metal. And the problem is that the real story of how the supply chain works is not well told.
Aha. So ham sandwiches come from vending machines. The problem is that we just are financial overlords and our press have really just forgotten. We've just forgotten over time where things actually come from, and that actual real value comes from the earth. So I talk about this in my Crash Course series as primary wealth, secondary wealth, and tertiary wealth. And what Robert is describing is a lot of people have spent too much time around tertiary wealth, and they've forgotten what primary and secondary mean. So what's primary wealth? Primary wealth is a big copper mine that hasn't been opened yet. It's copper ore in the ground. Nice, beautiful, azure, malachite, green, blue stuff, 10% ore grade. That would be primary wealth. It's the wealth that your nation had or has, you know, at the time when people started finding it and making use of it, right? Secondary wealth is what happens when we take that copper ore and we produce copper ingots out of it, or we bring fish from the ocean to market. Secondary wealth is the transformed value add of humans taking whatever this thing is and bringing it in a usable form to market. And it's also, secondary wealth is the means of production, right? So good, solid secondary wealth would be the oil well and all of its machinery as well. Tertiary wealth, stocks and bonds and derivatives and ones and zeros and hard disks, it's representations of wealth, but it's not actually real wealth. This is a study program I go over and over again. I teach this at college courses. This is in the Crash Course series, it's in the books, it's in the movies, the video series, but it's really important because money itself actually has no value, right? So if we're on a desert island together and a pallet washes up, if it's a pallet of $100 bills, we might be excited for a second, but its actual value to us there on that island is going to be low. We would rather have a pallet of bananas or medicine, you know, anything else that would be like very useful. Something that's actual tangible primary or secondary wealth would be great. So the problem is that we have a lot of people in positions of authority, even as, you know, far along it goes, 2023. And I've been talking about the copper story since even before then, because it's been so obvious that we're not going to be able to get enough copper out of the ground to do all the things we're planning to do with it. And once, I think maybe the green energy stories died back a bit because data centers came along, and now we have data centers, and those are all exciting, and nobody's squawking about how much energy they waste or pollution they make. Data centers, but data centers need cooling. And to do that, they use these copper cooling jackets around, or these little bars that they put around the CPU units themselves to transmit and carry that waste heat away. Bottom line is, whether we're making green energy stuff, we're making EV cars, we're making windmills, we're building more cars, we're putting up more buildings, or whatever we're doing with it, making data centers, we're going to need more copper. So that's an astonishing story. So it's very easy to find data like this out there. So this is coming from the Global Critical Minerals Outlook from 2025. And within 10 years... minerals critical to power infrastructure and battery technologies could face double-digit shortfalls. These are massive. Look at copper. There's a 33% gap they're projecting here between what we're going to have, expected supply, and primary supply requirements. Like, what do you mean we're going to be missing tens of thousands and thousands and thousands of kilotons, right? You know, millions and millions of pounds. Lithium, same thing, huge gap. Nickel, huge gap. Cobalt, huge gap. Cobalt being used in batteries and as part of the anodes. At any rate, we're missing a lot. And that's by 2035. According to the Financial Times, demand for copper is forecast to outstrip supply by a really wide margin. Like, look at that. That's just massive. Now we're missing millions of tons, 10 million tons probably, just missing in action. And that's crazy. That's crazy. So I think I put this one out 2 years ago to my subscribers. I talked about how copper was maybe the new gold, and those are copper, big, just sheets of copper that straight out of the refinery. So is copper the new gold? Meaning, is copper about to go on a big bull run? Well, it kind of has already started there. Here we're looking at a monthly reading of copper. So this starts all the way back here in 2006. It went up a bit. Sort of bounced around here between $3 and $4 a pound back in 2006, 7, 8, collapsed all the way back to under $2 a pound in 2008 in the construct of the Great Financial Crisis. 2009 lifts off again, makes it all the way back over for 4 years and years and years and years of going down, bounces back up to 3 years of going all the way back down to 2, bounces to 4. And here we come along, and then finally here in 2025 starts to take off. And look at this. This is a brand new closing monthly high that we're working on here in May 13th as of today, $6.69 a pound. And when we look at that on a per ton basis, and because that's the other way, the LME, London Metal Exchange, is pricing it by the ton, T-O-N-N-E, that's 1,000 kilograms, which is what, 2,200 pounds-ish. With a normal short ton being 2,000 pounds. But you can see here, now we're approaching levels here over $14,000 a ton when we were just at $11,000 a ton just back in November of 2025. So pretty big increases. So that's what copper's doing. But the problem with copper is this. 20 years of paper price suppression. So copper's really, like every commodity, has been a victim of the so-called futures market, where people, speculators and big banks and actual producers and consumers and commercial hedgers all come together to set the price for things, everything, wheat, corn, oil, cocoa, copper. And for 20 years, basically, the price of copper really went nowhere. I mean, can you imagine, here you are in 2026 at the beginning of it, earning $4.50 a pound for copper, but you could have earned that basically 20 years ago. So, listen, mining is a very, very capital-intensive business, and it's an energy-intensive business, and it's subject to all the inflationary forces, inflation for the machines, the equipment, the energy, the steel, labor, all of that. Can you imagine any business you're running if your business was had to accept the same price for its output product today that it did 20 years ago? So what do you think the effect is, though, if this price suppression scheme I'm talking about has been right, that prices have been reduced below their fair market price? What do you think is happening to discoveries of new copper? How incentivized are people going to be to go out and discover more copper mines? Not very is the answer, and that's exactly what has happened. 2015, zero new mines were found. We have this one that was discovered, you know, put online in 2016, discovered, brought online. 2017, zero. And then 2018, one. 2019, zero. 2020, one. 2021, zero. 22, zero. 23, one. You can see all, look what we were doing back here in the 90s up through about 2006, 7, right? 8, 9, 10, 15, 17 new mines discovered, new copper discoveries found. And wow, that's terrible. So just hold this in, your mind. Remember, we're not finding more copper because we're not really incentivized to find more copper. Or there isn't more to find, but there's more to find. But we're just not properly incentivized because the price is wrong. The price signal is wrong. The price signal has been wrong. That's one of the things that the U.S. markets excel at, is making bad price signals. And bad price signals lead to bad outcomes. So carrying forward, we're going to listen to Robert Friedland again. Here he is at a recent summit. And so this is just from, I think that's this is earlier this year. Let's listen in.
Let me show you how bad this problem is. In human history, if we go back to Mohenjo-Daro, we have mined 700 million metric tons of copper. So we put that in a big cube. You see the Eiffel Tower for scale. It's about 430 meters by 430 meters. Approximately 80% of all the copper we've ever mined is still in human possession. Now, if you want to get that back, no problem. We can recycle that. All we have to do is tear down every building in the United States, every building in Europe, every building in Japan and all of China, and we can get back about 80% of that 700 million tons, but we'll be living and freezing in the dark. The lights are on here because the copper that's embedded in this building. We can tear down this university and get the copper back. Yeah, we can recycle it. How much are we using? We're consuming 30 million tons of copper a year, only 4 million tons of which is recycled. That means to maintain 3% GDP growth, now listen carefully, with no electrification, this is with burning oil and gas. To maintain global 3% GDP growth, we have to mine the same amount of copper in the next 18 years as we mined in the last 10,000 years. In the next 18 years, I've got to mine the same amount of copper as we mined in the last 10,000 years without electrification.
What? In the next 18 years, just to maintain our 3% GDP growth, we are going to have to mine another, well, as much as copper has been mined in all of human history. Wow. All right. He's going to drive this point home. Let's keep listening.
Without data centers, without solar and wind and the greening of the world economy, you people have no idea whatsoever what we're facing. You're dreaming. Since 1900, the energy to produce copper, the energy you need to make copper, is 16-fold up. As the ore grade in the world goes down, we need more and more energy to...
These are all points I made in the crash course back in 2008. As the copper ore grades get worse, right? Instead of a 1% ore grade, it becomes a 0.5% ore grade. The amount of energy that's required to produce the copper out of that ore doesn't go up linearly. It's not just twice as bad at 0.5% as it is at 1% ore grade, for example. It goes exponentially worse, right? It's just unbelievable. So he's making so many good points here that it's just absolutely vital that we all absorb them.
Produce the very metal that produces the energy, and water consumption has doubled. So grades are declining in the world's mines. The easy copper mines were mined. They're like 100-year-old ladies laying in bed waiting to die in Chile. So Chile counts for a lot. That's 24% of global copper mine production. But, you know, their costs are in the third or fourth quartile. They're very expensive. They burn coal in the Chilean grid. And solar doesn't work for a mine because the sun only shines 5 hours a day. Solar's useless unless you have grid-scale storage. So we're heading for a train wreck in Chile. We need 6 giant Tier 1 mines to come online every year between now and 2050, when I'm scheduled to be 100 years old.
What? We need 6 Tier 1 mines coming online every year from now to 2050 to have this all balanced out? Do you see what the problem is here? I mean, it's just so obvious, and it's just astonishing that copper, its price has not been forward looking at all. It has not even begun to price in what he's talking about. It's not going to be there. It's just not. So when I said copper is the new gold, it's because we have 10 years of data behind us right now, and we have an average of less than 1 new mine coming online, let alone 6. So when's enough data? When we have 20 years of data? 40 years of data? To me, 10 years is plenty, okay? This is such an obvious story. So when I say the commodity super cycle is about to start, the commodities bull market started. In fact, we're just dialing in on copper, not because it's a special exemplar necessarily, although it's special. But this story can be repeated across so many different commodities, including oil, including the grains, including all kinds of things, but silver too, platinum. How did we get here? How did we forget the most basic things, which is before you can produce it, you got to find it, all right? So that's the point he goes on to make here. Now, we're going to have to talk about something because he had 2 important points in there. One, that over the next 18 years, right, we're going to have to mine as much copper as has been mined in all of human history. 10,000 years of taking this stuff out of the ground. And in the next 18 years, we're going to have to get the same amount out. Okay, that's one. What does that mean? How is that happening? And he tied that to 3.5% GDP growth. He said, hey, if you want the GDP growth, you're going to have to do this. Okay, and there's a reason for that. And we have to talk about something so we can share the understanding of why that is. And it starts with this. It's this stuff called exponential growth. See, the problem here is that you and I were humans, which means we're really good at linear things, right? A linear thing might be, you know, a pitcher unleashes a 100-mile-an-hour fastball. The batter has less than a tenth of a second to calculate where it's going to be, what the rotation of the seams is, and make a very calculated adjustment to try and put the bat exactly where that ball is going to be. And people do it. It's astonishing. But the very minute that ball leaves the pitcher's hand, it begins to decelerate linearly. So we can make that calculation, even if it's in the blink of an eye, less than the blink of an eye. But that same batter, who's totally astonishingly amazing at doing that calculation, when they encounter an unexpected patch of ice on their front stoop, they're going to go down like a sack of potatoes, just like the rest of us, right? Because when you slip on ice, you are no longer subject to a linear force. You're subject to gravity. Gravity is 9.8 meters per second squared. Not linear, squared. What is this exponential stuff? So we're just not really well constructed as humans to understand exponential functions. So I have a way of explaining it, hopefully, that makes it easy. I've done this many times, and people seem to sort of get it. So what's exponential growth? Exponential growth is something that looks like you get these hockey stick charts, you know, that, oh, the next 18 years, we're going to have to mine as much copper as has been mined in all the rest of history. So what that's talking about is it's a doubling. And it's a feature of exponential functions where the next doubling, when you go from we've mined 700 million tons, now we need another 700 million tons, right? That's mining as much as all of human history combined, right? Let me back that up a sec. And that doubling means that it's an exponential function. And when exponential functions have a doubling, that next doubling consumes as much as all of the prior doublings, all the prior story combined. It's one of the amazing and also terrifying features of exponential functions. And so I got all of this from a series of lectures from Dr. Albert Bartlett. Had the great pleasure of meeting him, University of Colorado professor. He had this really brilliant discourse on exponential functions. You could look it up on YouTube and find it. It's brilliant. Highly recommended. And one of his quotes is, he said, "The greatest shortcoming of the human race is our inability to understand the exponential function." He's absolutely right. 100%. So I'm going to, let's see if we can understand it together. So the hockey stick chart, how do we understand this? Okay. I'm going to do a little thought experiment. Let's imagine I have a magic eyedropper, and this magic eyedropper is magic because when I put that drop of water in your left hand there, it's going to double every minute. So after 1 minute, you have 2 drops. And after 2 minutes, you have 4 drops of water in your hand. And after about 5 minutes, you could fill a thimble up. That's how fast it's growing. Okay. So here's the thought experiment. We go to this random stadium that I've selected. Ah, it's Yankee Stadium. And I'm going to put a wall across that back wall right there. So the park is now watertight. And the second thing we're going to do is right up there at the highest row, bleacher seats right there, we're going to handcuff you to that. Okay. So you're handcuffed to the highest row of bleacher seats in this watertight park, 12 o'clock in the afternoon, exactly. I put this magic drop down there on the pitcher's mound, bloop, and it starts to do its thing. Question, how long do you have to escape from your handcuffs? People guess all kinds of things. I don't know what's in your head, but, well, the answer is, if we begin this at 12 o'clock exactly, the stadium is going to be filled at 12:50. And if I've underestimated the volume of a park, the park by 100%, then the answer is 12:51. This answer around 50 shows up almost at any scale when you're trying to figure out an exponential function. It's something really magic happens somewhere between 45 and 55 of those doubling periods. All right. Which relates to our debt markets, believe it or not. That isn't the important question. Important question is, at what time is this park still 97% empty space? And how many of you realize the seriousness of your predicament? The answer is, at 12:45, it's still 97% empty space. There's only 3% water is knee-deep in the infield. But then it goes from 3% to 6 to 12, 25, 50, 100, right? Pretty much. It's very fast. So look, we just live in a world surrounded by these exponential charts. Like when I was born in the early 1960s, there were about 3 billion people on the planet. Now there's 8 plus, right? Here's the important part. I don't need you to understand math. It's just that exponential systems really speed up at the end. This is what Robert Friedland was referring to. We're at this speeding up portion and almost nobody is grokking it. They're still getting ham sandwiches out of vending machines. They fly there in airplanes and we've lost that physical connection to reality. But here's the reality when it comes to copper. Looking at major copper discoveries since 1900, going to 1920, 40, 60, 1980, the year 2000, 2020, you can see we found these big copper mines here. And the size of the circle, two things we're noting with this. The size of the circle is how big the copper discovery is. So diameter reference, this is 100 million metric tons. That's massive. We found these massive, these are even larger than that, bigger. 200 million metric ton discoveries. And also how deep down they are, right? If they're right on the surface, like these zeros, that's awesome. You just find this blue stuff sticking out of the side of the hill and you're like, great, dig here. And that's awesome. But then over time, two things have been happening. We've had to go deeper and deeper and deeper. Look, some of these things are down 500 meters. This one's almost down 1,000 meters, 3,000 feet underground. You know how hard it is to get down 3,000 feet underground? It ain't easy. So it's very easy to see the story of the copper trajectory is that over time, we've been finding fewer and they've been a lot deeper and they've been a lot smaller. And by the way, many cases, what's being hidden in these smaller circles is the size of the deposit may be big, but it's now a really crappy ore grade where they were 10%, then 5%, then 1%. The average ore grade last I looked in the world of new discoveries was clocking in about 0.5%. So these little circles just mean how many metric tons are in there. But if these represent more dilute, that is terrible yields in terms of ore yields, then you have to work so much harder, more energy, much more cost. It's just so much harder. But this chart alone should be giving everybody exactly the understanding and the reference we need. We're going to have to struggle mightily to get more copper out of the ground going forward, let alone as much copper as has been mined in all of history over the next 18 years. But then what about the 18 years after that? How do we continue to get this 3.5% mythical economic growth if we're running out of the raw feedstock for that stuff? Now, I don't mean that we've run out, but I'm using the term running out. And also, guess what? The same story is true for all sorts of other different critical items. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to be talking about food as a part of this commodity supercycle story. We'll be right back. Today's markets are more volatile than ever. With ongoing economic and geopolitical uncertainty, navigating such environments requires thoughtful, adaptive strategies, not a one-size-fits-all approach. At Peak Financial Investing, our registered investment advisory firm connects clients with experienced wealth managers who focus on active portfolio management. These professionals use evidence-based strategies designed to respond to changing conditions, not outdated formulas, but customized approaches grounded in research, discipline, and risk awareness. We believe in open, informed conversations, including discussing tools like precious metals and diversification as part of a broader financial strategy. Every investor's situation is unique, and our advisors tailor their guidance accordingly. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com today to schedule your free consultation and explore how proactive management can support your financial goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, proud to work with Peak Financial Investing, and my support reflects my professional views. I encourage you to take control of your financial future by making informed decisions. All right, welcome back, everybody. Let's turn now to food. Obviously, what's happening in the Middle East right now, where we have about 40% of the world's nitrogenous fertilizer, urea, has not been shipped out during the all critical spring planting and fertilizing season, we're going to see much reduced yields around the world. As well, we're seeing places that simply because of the cost increases associated with that, like Thailand, a lot of farmers have decided they can't afford or they've opted not to fertilize. And so that's going to create downstream food pressures because we're going to see a lot less food produced in those countries, but they're still going to want to buy it. So that's going to create food inflationary pressures. As well, when we're looking at food, sometimes other things come in to get you, and this is why we have a kind of an inflationary cycle this calendar year. In the United States, this is going to... that shouldn't say 145. Mentally, right? 14 years. This is going to be our lowest, worst wheat harvest in 14 years. I don't know how that five got snuck in there. When we look at wheat prices, this is current as of, you can see here, May 13th. You can see here, this is the big run-up in 2008. Remember, oil went to $148 a barrel. Oil and food prices very closely aligned. So we had that big spike. Look, that went to $14 a bushel. I mean, $13.50-ish. Here again in 2022, when we had that other inflationary spike coming out of COVID, plus also the issue around the Russia-Ukraine conflict, we saw another spike again somewhere between $11, $12, $13 a bushel. So yes, wheat is now, you know, clocked some pretty good returns here over the past few days coming into 2026, but it's got a long way to go still. And we're going to see a lot of food pressures and food pricing increases as we go forward. I was just shocked I was shocked a year ago going to the grocery store, a year and a half ago. And I was just shocked again recently, shocked again. It's just been astonishing. Now, the same story, though, of sometimes, you know, it's just Mother Nature, sometimes it's bad luck, but also we have human-derived things that are sort of conspiring in here that can create much higher food price inflation pressures going forward. In the United States, we also have the unfortunate situation that for reasons, our cattle herds are at the lowest they've been since the 50s. So on a per capita basis, you can imagine it's even worse than that. Some of the lowest beef levels we have in the United States and ever. And that's going to create higher prices for beef as well. If we see the kind of increases I think we're going to see in the prices for corn, for soybeans, for other grains, those are the things that you then feed to chickens and to poultry, chickens, other poultry, pork, and beef to fatten them up. That all create, if these get more expensive, then these get more expensive. So we're going to see a lot of food inflationary pressures over this next year, as well as energy pressures. Again, a lot of that because of the human decision to do some silly things, by my estimation, my judgment, in the Middle East. But we're going to have to live with the consequences of that. It's going to be tricky. So now, let's take a quick look at silver and platinum as, I think, representatives, too, of this commodity super cycle that's about to really kick off. Silver had this enormous run coming out of 2024, vaulted all the way up to 120 an ounce. This is a monthly chart, so each one of these little bars is a month. And then it had this big decline here at the beginning of 2026, and it's been since climbing back. Same story for platinum, and both of these have pretty intense. They almost look like identical charts, right? So clearly you can see this isn't just a silver story, because silver and platinum are totally different metals with totally different uses and totally different supply-demand characteristics, but their price action has been behaving very similarly from a correlation standpoint, highly correlated. They look a lot alike, all right? Now, silver on a daily chart rose recently. It's just started to poke its head up again. Time I took this chart here, snapshot on May 13th, it was up another $3.67 an ounce to $89.26. Came out of this wedge, this falling wedge right here, and it popped out decisively. That's called a breakout in technical terms. Off it goes. Now, why did it do that? Why did it suddenly decide May, you know, here we go? It may have something to do with this. China's net silver imports in tons, highest in ever, as far as I'm aware, and largest in 20 years, and I think that's 20 years of data, but suddenly China was like on a net basis, was like consuming a lot of silver. It suddenly U-turned on that. So could be a little bit of demand there. In India, the Prime Minister Modi actually implored his people of his land to stop buying so much gold and silver because they're trying to preserve their foreign exchange reserves, which otherwise would get spent on importing gold and silver because they're going to need to import food, fertilizer, and energy going forward. So, a lot of people are not fooled by that and would rather have silver than money. All right. China is also buying platinum, too. So this is an article in Bloomberg from May 10th. Chinese refiner, the headline reads here, seeing strong platinum demand from new contracts. So they have a futures exchange there, and their futures exchange operates with a lot more clear delivery apparatus. The United States one's a little murky on purpose. So carrying on from the article here, quote, a major Chinese metals refiner is seeing a large volume of demand for platinum to deliver against a new local futures contract, a sign of how the product is luring more of the metal into the country. And pro tip, folks, there isn't that much of this stuff kicking around in the world for a lot of reasons. The increased Chinese demand is likely to tighten international supply of the precious metal. You bet it will, particularly as Beijing has long maintained restrictions on exports. Global prices of platinum, which also has industrial uses, have more than doubled over the past year. As of the end of last week, there was around 14.4 tons of open interest for the platinum futures contract for June delivery, with around 0.6 tons, or 600 kilograms, of warehouse inventories on warrants. Well, we're going to have to deliver 14.4 tons, potentially, but don't worry, we have 0.6 tons. So this is creating a bit of a stir, obviously. Shenzhen Weixin is one of the biggest precious metals refiners in China, producing around 200 tons of gold, 20 tons of platinum. Last year, many clients are asking to sign long-term contracts with us in order to secure supply of platinum in the future, Wang said, adding these are still under consideration. So we're getting to the scrambly stage here where people just want to have access. We just want to get it. Like, we need the platinum. And platinum in the United States, you know, we probably think of it as sort of like a in the jewelry store. That's where platinum shows up. But it actually has extraordinary industrial applications as a catalyst. And you might know them as catalytic converters in a car. There's a lot of platinum, sometimes hot swappable with palladium, platinum palladium. But platinum is the ultimate catalyst function. And of course, you use that in industrial processes as well. It looks like China's trying to get as much as they can because, ooh, turns out Russia's not producing as much platinum, and South Africa's having its own difficulties. Meanwhile, you know, copper, the story of silver from a supply standpoint, silver, 70% of that is a byproduct of other metals mining, particularly zinc and copper. So look at this. Here's a big old chart of what's going on. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 mines that are not operating all that well for copper, starting with the Cobre Panama. It has its approximate copper capacity output in kilotons per annum, 300,000 tons to 350,000 tons of copper, fully offline. So this is a political dispute, you know. Mining contract ruled unconstitutional, so that's sort of a Panama thing. The Grasberg in Indonesia is the number two mine in the world, 722 to 775,000 tons of copper, partially offline. It had underground mud rush. The Kamoa Kalua mine, number eight in the world in the DRC, materially constrained. El Teniente is partially offline. This one is constrained. This one's below plan, structurally constrained. So we're already having difficulties. In fact, when we look at 2025, 6 out of 10 copper producers missed their production targets in 2025. And this would be the production target. And here's the blue bars, what they actually produce. So this, they missed. These people missed. These missed. Yeah. These other ones, so five of them sort of hit or exceeded. This one did exceed their targets down here. But again, we have this story that there's some struggle to output. Struggle. As the world struggles with missing sulfuric acid from the Gulf of Mexico because of the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, that's going to impact a lot of the copper mining operations out there because they use sulfuric acid to leach the copper out of the ore as part of the refining process. But as well, the Russian concern, Norilsk Nisk Nickel, is one of the world's largest nickel and palladium producers. It just announced the following production declines quarter over quarter here on May 3rd. Nickel down 28%. Ah, that's a huge decline. Copper down 12%. Whoops. Palladium down 14%. And, platinum down 26%. This is, again, one of the larger producers of these things. I'm starting to see supply shortfalls show up all over the commodity space. And all of these ripples and impacts from the Strait of Hormuz closure are just going to absolutely ripple through this industry in a big way. So not only are we seeing geological depletion, where the mines are just getting fewer and farther and deeper and harder to prosecute, we're seeing as well all sorts of other impacts that are about to come up because of the energy part of this story. So this all kind of conspires to say we're going to see a lot higher prices for a lot of these things, which means, of course, that the next thing we're going to have to prepare for, and Paul and I have been warning everybody about this for a long time, is that the next part of the story is that inflation is coming. Warning, folks, inflation is inbound. So let's talk about that really quickly. The bad news is that the most recent reading for this week, on May 13th, the producer price index, the reading came in scorching hot, came in at about 6% PPI. Of course, this is being driven in no small measure by the price increases for energy due to the Strait of Hormuz closure. And as goes PPI, so goes CPI, just with a lag of about 2 months. Robert Infra here says, I got bad news and I got really bad news. PPI leads CPI by about 2 months. So you see here, this PPI reading in white has just been put forward about 2 months in time. And then it overlaps with CPI very nicely over time. And CPI is already printed at the highest level in 3 years, and it looks like it's only going to get much worse. So PPI is up here, CPI is way down here, CPI is going to follow. So what does that mean, CPI at 6%? And what is this really going to look like? Again, Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management and myself have been talking about this particular next chart for months because I've been worried about this, and now it looks like it's happening. Do we have a nearly perfect inflationary repeat here of everything we see in the world? Probably. Probably. So in the 1970s versus today, the dark blue line is the 1970s. So bad old 1970s, that inflation. And what we had here was this blue line rose all the way up here, right-hand scale. And so it went up to 12-ish percent, fell all the way back to just about 5%, and then climbed all the way up to nearly 15%. And then it fell back again. But notice here, this is 1972, 74, 76. So that was a four-year inflationary burn, about a two-year lull. And then there was this four-year inflationary burn again here, because we went from 26, 28, 30, or 78, 80, 82. So if we're just getting started, if we're going to be repeating, it means that about 2 years from now, we're going to hit a peak that I estimate is going to be a far higher than this one, because this energy shock is way worse than the energy shocks and that led to this. The money printing today is far worse than the money printing that led to this. So what did we have in the 70s and 80s? Well, you still had all that excess government deficit spending because, you know, there was the Vietnam War back here. We also had the OPEC energy crisis. Then we had this other energy crisis. So energy shocks plus printing and bad governance. Those gave you your shocks. What do we have in place today? Money printing, energy shock, and bad governance. So if this is right, I think we're going to go way over 10% inflation. In fact, my bogey for this next run is going to take us about 2 years from now to about 18% inflation. Mark it down. Hope I'm wrong. Now, what happens, though, if you have inflation? You know what happens when you have inflation? It's a multi-edged sword. And one of the edges of that sword is that, well, I don't want to hold bonds yielding 3 or 4% if inflation is going to be 12 or 13%, because then it turns out that we're going to remember a phrase from the 70s where investors used to call U.S. Treasuries certificates of confiscation, because the rate of inflation was much higher than the rate of interest on those bonds. So you lost money by holding them. That money was confiscated. So that's why they called them, jokingly, waggishly, but seriously, certificates of confiscation. As of today, we're seeing here that the 10-year yield is now at 4.475. It is up pretty strongly since the start of the war. We now, in the 20-year and the 30-year, we are now over 5%. And in fact, this is the highest auction yield of over 5% on the 30-year, which just got auctioned off this week, since August of 2007. We got to go way back to find yields on 30-year paper that are this high. They're going a lot higher. There's not a chance in the world. If you ask me right now, Chris, what yield would you accept today to begin holding U.S. government paper for 30 years? It's high double digits, honestly. You'd have to pay me 15, 16% today, maybe 20, 25% in a year or two when things get a little dicier. Maybe, I don't know. We'll have to see how it unfolds. But I'm not going to be buying U.S. government paper for 30 years at 5% under these circumstances. Not a chance in the world. But it goes well beyond the United States. In Japan, we've been watching all of their long maturity bond yields are just like screaming higher. They have been since 2020 as they bottomed out, and they've been coming up in here. This includes the 30-year in red, the 20-year in blue, the 10-year in green, and the 40-year in gray. And we can see they're just like, whoop, all going up a lot higher. You know who else is? UK. These are United Kingdom 30-year government bonds. If you can't see what the heck's going on there, good luck with your investing career. These yields are skyrocketing. It's going to create a fiscal crisis in the UK. It's going to create a mortgage crisis. The poor people of the UK, they just can't catch a break these days. And their bond market is just going insane. Now, why are all these bond markets going crazy like this? Well, as mentioned, inflation's about to go higher. The fiscal irresponsibility of the various governments involved is extraordinary. We're also at the tail end of a really, really long credit cycle bubble that's been with us for decades, honestly. And so it looks like that's about to crack. And as well, there are other pressures now, at least on the U.S. side, where turns out for crazy reasons, countries like China, countries like Russia, countries like the Gulf Coast states no longer want to hold treasuries, and or they're in a position of needing to sell their treasuries because they got to fund some local destruction back home, and they're going to have to fund that somehow. And so this is actually a pretty big deal. We're witnessing, I believe, the end of this fiat currency regime, and it's going to take a while for that to gasp its way to the finish line or its conclusion. And along the way, we're going to have to be exceedingly dynamic and nimble about how we see this coming on the one hand, and then what do we do in order to protect ourselves on the other hand. So this is why we strongly advise people work with a good financial advisor who's nimble, somebody like Paul Kiker and his team at Kiker Wealth Management. They see all this stuff. You can talk to them about any of these things we've talked about, and they won't look at you like a dog listening to white noise. You know, they get it, and they're not going to fight you on any of this. It's a good thing. You get to talk about it, have a reasoned discussion, discuss the risks as they actually are. If you're like me and you're thinking, you're of the age where you're like, you know, retirement is like not that far away, the idea of double-digit inflation is absolutely paralyzing, as it should be. It's so difficult to make plans when you've got this uncertain of an environment. So that's why having a good strategy, a good plan, a non-emotional plan, a strategy that you know you can live by, those are really important to have right now. I mean, like, I can't think of a more important time in history than right now to have a risk-managed strategy laid over your wealth and your portfolio. So that's the service that Paul Kiker and his team actually offer, high-level planning and really good strategic risk mitigation strategies, because let's face it, we're entering a commodity super cycle, which is also partly due to structural undersupply, underinvestment, and partly due to magnificently bad decisions politically in the Middle East, and also due to magnificent levels of money printing. The Federal Reserve, as we noted in last week's Finance U, has already printed this calendar year, 2026, as of May, $176 billion, thrown it into the markets, driven the markets higher, but also now we're going to start seeing everything being highly inflationary. The idea of the Federal Reserve cutting interest rates and throwing more money into this environment is one of the most explosive ideas I can possibly imagine, especially for people who are trying to live on a fixed income, or people who are trying to plan, or anybody who isn't already making $250,000 or more a year. These things are just going to be absolutely devastating. And once you understand how that money printing connects to, well, how the financial markets actually work, and you're looking at the pressure valves and gauges that tell you what's happening, that's the treasuries, silver price, gold, these things, these are all the dials and knobs we look at carefully on a daily basis. And then, most importantly, you have to understand how energy feeds into all of that. And that is one of the most important insights you can possibly have. And once you put all that into a mix, what do you get? Hopefully you have a plan. And that plan should include becoming more resilient, not having all your eggs in one basket, being much more nimble, and being absolutely dialed into what's happening in the world, at least enough so that you know what you need to do next and how you should spend your precious time and where you should invest your precious stored wealth. So with that, thank you very much for listening, and we'll have Paul Kiker back with us next week again. Hope you enjoyed this. Bye for now.